It's really a pleasure to be here and talk about a slice of a adaptation of Project Connect Health Systems that we did in Metro Detroit. I just moved from Michigan this year to Philly, and it's been awesome. Although most of my community partners are still in Detroit, and so I just want to give a shout out to them. And one of the things we wanted to do as we were thinking about how to refer young men who have sex with men to clinics was to take a step back in our CBPR process and say, where exactly are we sending people? So we spend millions of dollars as a country to engage people to do testing and then repeat testing. There's actually no way to truly monitor at a community level whether we're sending them to the right places and the experiences that young men are living in when we send them to these locations. So I can't say I'm a young MSM anymore. My youth advisory board tells me that now that I'm over 30, I'm not young. When I was a young MSM, I was a test counselor, and sometimes I would see clients come into my clinic, and I would say, oof, you just went into the wrong test counselor. This is going to be bad. And so we wanted to see, you know, to what extent is that really true? So in Southeast Michigan, the majority of cases are actually right here in the Mitten, where the Detroit metro area is. That includes Flint all the way down to Detroit, all the way to Jackson and Ann Arbor. And the majority of cases are actually among young men between the ages of 13 to 29. Not surprisingly, there is a lot of concurrence between HIV diagnosis and incidence and STI infections in six of the nine counties, with some data suggesting that adolescent and young adult men carry the large burden of syphilis, for example, in our region. So Aetha was just talking about cultural competency and cultural humility. I feel like it's the perfect segue into this conversation. So HRSA talks about cultural competency as a process by which we want to make sure that we empower providers to understand cross-cultural needs and to be responsive to diverse communities and populations. Now, in public health, we have this term called cultural humility, which is a little bit different, which is that once you've figured out these checklists that you can cross off to say that you've been culturally competent, you also have to be willing to understand that it's a dynamic process and that you have to always be open to challenge your own assumptions and understandings of how clients and communities behave. So I'll be talking about the distinctions between the two in my talk. So I figured I would just start with like best practice. And so a best practice in a HIV and STI clinic requires six fundamental things: respect, following guidelines that have been set forward by our peers, doing patient-centered counseling and organization of services around the patient-centered needs, making sure that we always protect, if not enrich, the autonomy of our clients, ensure privacy, confidentiality, and safety, and also allow folks to ask questions so they leave empowered and have more skills when they leave. So these are the AIDS.gov check marks of HIV and STI locations in our region. There are 53 of them at the time when we did the study. And I'm always surprised not only at the geographic distance, right? Michigan is a very, very large place. So we're asking you to navigate sometimes really long spaces to get tested. But more than that, there's this assumption around test locators that I have a really challenging problem with, and that problem is in every other area of our life we ask around what is the best place that I should go to. So if I said to you, you know, I'm just going to give you all a ticket to this pizzeria, before you probably go get sick, you're going to ask someone, hey, is this pizzeria a good place? Is it a good pizza? What about their tomato sauce? Do they actually have vegan cheese? Because I'm vegan. And yet when we think about HIV and STI testing, the assumption that we often make is that these sites are all equal, that their quality of services are actually highly competent and also able to respond to the diverse needs of young MSM, particularly young MSM of color. So I was once a retail staff at a clothing store, and the first thing they teach you in a said store, I don't want to say the name so that I'm not endorsing it, is you should be aware that as the company actually sends people into the store that you will not know as actors to figure out whether or not you're actually doing what you're supposed to be doing. And we use that to understand performance metrics. We also use it to continue coaching our staff, our employees. And so we said, what if we did that for HIV and STI testing in Southeast Michigan? We've seen it done in family planning. So what would this look like in the context of young MSM? So we created a listing of all the 53 sites, and we trained 5 mystery shoppers or secret shoppers who were master's students in public health and who identified as young MSM to go get tested. And we trained them on self-efficacy and understanding the guidelines and policies around HIV and STI testing. And so we had 2 shoppers visit each site at random times to try to diversify who the test counselor could be and if morning service was different from evening service or weekends and days. And there are 3 exceptions that I'll talk about as to why we didn't go to some places. One is sites that once you were there tried to tell a shopper that didn't have an option. They had to get forced testing, which actually they don't. They actually can walk out. They said that they didn't require ID, but then demanded to see an ID from the client once they got to the physical location. Or they said they had a sliding fee scale, but any STI test would require more than $60 to be done. And just thinking about social validity, what 15-year-old has $60 to just go get a rectal gonorrhea test? I don't know any yet. I wish that wasn't the case. So we visited 46 out of these 53 sites at the end of this summer experience. And what we tried to tell shoppers was to not make up stories. So just go in. We're not going to ask you what your sexual behaviors are. We don't need to know that either. We just want you to go and say, listen, this is who I am. Let's go through the motions and get me tested. And then they filled out a qualitative and a quantitative checklist about their experience. There's a lot. There's actually a 50-item checklist. We've actually been able to trim it down and do some psychometric properties, and I'm happy to share that with folks. But the major issues have to do with visibility of signs and symbols at the clinic, use of language in medical forms that is both trans-inclusive and also LGB-inclusive, conversations about friendliness and culture, the environment, privacy and confidentiality, relationship context, how well the counseling session actually went. If there was a counseling session, we'll get into that. Did you talk about safer sex education? Did the provider seem competent to you? And did you have any negative interactions around race, class, education attainment, or your sexual practices? And so we found actually quite a diverse group of experiences. The first one was great. They follow best practices, and I won't read the slides for you, because you probably can read faster than I can say it. But there was a lot of competency at the different clinics. We saw people being really candid and supportive of their testing experiences. But then we also saw some missed opportunities. So here's an example of a shopper who goes to get a rapid test at a clinic, and the nurse practitioner swabs and walks out, leaves this young man with his rapid test running. Not knowing that this young man actually is a test counselor himself, and he actually knows what the test will say. But again, no counseling, no opportunity to come back and, you know, use that 10, 20-minute window to talk about the patient's needs. I'm going to show you just a little bit of all the data we've quantified. And what I really wanted to alert you on is the difference between HIV-only testing sites and STI comprehensive testing sites. So when we look at the differences between them and the percentages, it's actually quite saddening. And I just highlighted 3 that are statistically significant, although I think we can make improvements in all these metrics. The first one, that STI comprehensive testing sites were much less likely to actually report that a provider had sat down with the client and said, do you want to set some safer sex goals as compared to HIV testing only locations? Didn't ask about relationship status. And were less likely to talk about whether they knew how to use a condom, if they need to explore what type of condom was best for them, and lube. And I think to this crowd, I don't have to explain the mechanics of why lube is important if you want to use condoms, right? Just basic physics of friction. So lube is the final frontier. So here's where the cultural competency framework starts breaking apart. We saw instances where they would just look at the intake form and say, MSM. And all of a sudden, the counselor activated these cognitive heuristics, these stereotypes of who this person might be. Instead of asking the client specifically about his sexual behaviors, it just goes into the rhetoric of you're MSM, you're at high risk, you should be doing better, instead of asking, have you been sexually active? Why are you here? Do you even engage in anal intercourse? So again, this very difficult moment of missing an opportunity to talk about the client and not the group that we all are so fondly calling at risk. And so what is the implication of always talking about high-risk groups when it comes to clinical practice? There is also several really traumatic instances where we actually saw that the patient-provider exchange was completely broken and trust was lost. One of them was a nurse practitioner who was very well-meaning and very friendly at the beginning and then starts bullying the client to want to get a penile swab and do a urethral test, even though now, you know, once we came back and we heard about this, we found out there was no clinical reason why a urethral swab should have been even offered to this young man. I'll just read you a little bit because it's I think very powerful. She did a rapid test and didn't explain anonymity or confidentiality. And Michigan is a HIV reporting state, which has implications for the safety of our youth. She asked me to wait outside and didn't do any counseling for me. She seemed really disappointed that my results were not what she expected. She said, with your history, I was certain you were going to be positive, but you seem to be negative. I'm going to give you some condoms, use them for every, you know, for sex every time. And the baggie was called the no-nonsense kit, because, you know, we all engage in nonsense. And so very much the shopper wrote at the end of his assessment that it not only was unethical, but we shouldn't be sending kids to this site. Again, there's another example where, again, there was a urethral swab exchange, a big push to get this young man to get tested, and got bullied into getting the test. I'll let you read it because it's just extremely traumatic. But, you know, as somebody who works with these people and who is part of this community, the most traumatic thing was seeing this young man come back in pain and limping because not only the test was invasive, but it had been done incorrectly. And then we wonder why young men don't want to go get tested. So we thought that our community board, which included agency directors, when seeing this data, really thought that we should be transparent about the process and give technical assistance. And so we actually wrote letters to every agency and said, you know, over the summer we've visited and we've done an assessment, and we at the University of Michigan want to come and give you some technical assistance, not only to celebrate the really great things you're doing, but also some areas where it might help your program planning in the future. So again, it's always built around we can all keep growing and not we gotcha, we're going to tell the state. We actually don't. We don't tell the state anything. And the majority of the sites actually wanted feedback. Most of them were done in person. And we brought them their custom-made report that included both qualitative and quantitative data. And so an example is here with some of the metrics where we tell them their site score as well as the median and the mean. So they can see how they're performing in comparison to other people in these agencies. And what was interesting is, like, the stages of grief emerged in these calls, right? So people were very defensive. And then when they see the results, they're like, oh, there's some apprehension. They're like, so tell me more about what we found. And then they see the results and they're like, oh, my God, okay, we're not as terrible as I thought we were going to be, which says something, I think, already. And then they're eager to know, first of all, who are you giving these results to? And second of all, can we use this data for our own purposes? And so in the spirit of CBPR, we actually, to this day, we still help people write in their program plans that the University of Michigan Sex Lab, which I used to direct, did this evaluation, and that here are some things that we're actually doing above other sites, and here are some things where we need more funding to be specific and responsive to the need. So, but it's interesting to see in this 30-minute, 45-minute conversation, the at least four of the six steps of grief go through. There is only one instance where it didn't move from defensiveness to anything else. There was one site, actually it was the worst site, as you might imagine, where when we talked about the results, the executive director told us that it was impossible that these data were coming from their clinic, because their test counselors go through a 15-minute LGBT cultural competency training, and therefore it must have been that our shoppers fabricated the data, to which I very charmingly smiled. And I said, I'm just amazed that in 15 minutes you've been able to figure out what's taken me 33 years to sort out. Can you show me your lesson plan? Right. It's not just that I don't think any of us come into this work because they're going to make money. I think we're in agreement on that. STI testing is not really a lucrative field. But what we actually heard was that agencies themselves are under pressure, and that once we had these conversations, we could put it in context. The state mandating that they increase their number of tests. And so one of the nurses, when we showed them the forced urethral swab, started crying. And she said, I remember this case. Our director had just told us that our funding might get cut if we didn't increase our numbers of MSM. And I just thought, well, here's an MSM, I'll increase the number. So thinking about how policies themselves might be structuring environments that actually are reducing the friendliness of these sites is important. Not having sufficient materials, not having quality control systems in place at any level, but also no incentive to do so, is something that I think, as you know, in terms of policy, we can really change. The perception that training that we already have is sufficient, so again, thinking about cultural humility instead of cultural competency. And also, none of us seem to be counseling the same way. So we had some counselors who said, well, I mean, I could chat with them and do an action plan, but I kind of want to scare them a little. So I make them go back outside and think for 10 minutes about what they just told me. And then when I have the results, I bring them back. So this idea of, like, I can use fear as a tactic seems to go unnoticed in some clinics. So how are we also able to kind of counsel each other as test counselors and make sure that we're when we see it, we say something, right? See something, say something. Being like, don't you have a client right now? Go back. I think we need to go back and really think about what is the best practice around counseling and when are we not doing it. There's some recommendations to put it together. One of them is to offer opportunities for clients themselves to give you feedback. And right now, there is no systematic way that the state or the county or the federal government actually uses to understand feedback forms. Every agency has their own form. We never see it. So if you're getting tax dollars, perhaps we should know what your quality improvement is, not to punish you, but to then allocate specific funds to help you increase your capacity and be responsive to certain groups. Mandate booster sessions for staff and providers. Review quality and compliance regulations throughout the year. Try to get more funding, always, right? And also thinking about discussions where providers can share experience and figure out how do they respond to their donors, but also to their communities. It's using, hopefully, a cultural humility framework to reduce stereotype threat instead of cultural competence. The Connect Health Systems actually has just been funded as a randomized controlled trial in 3 cities, and we call it Get Connected. It's an online app. It'll be done in Philadelphia, Atlanta, and Houston, and we will be doing an initial CBPR assessment of the shopper experience. And then we've actually created now an algorithm behind the scenes so that when clients go get tested, they can give kind of a private Yelp HIPAA-compliant review. I'll say that now before people are going to go like, oh, my God. But the idea is not to show it to anyone other to the site. So sites wanted kind of these it's hard for us to track it. Can you build an app that tracks it for us? And so sites will now be able to get quarterly reports on all these different metrics and how they're doing. And our hope is that we can actually assess and evaluate how well this real-time feedback on a quarterly basis improves services. And with that, I will acknowledge both CDC and NIH for their support for this work.